Blog Talk Radio.
Have you been feeling upset, disappointed with people, down on yourself, feeling as if life is not treating you well, especially during this holiday season? You may be suffering from upside-down thinking. Welcome to the Healthy Baby Boomers Network Blog Talk Radio Show. I'm your host, Dr. Erica Goodstone, licensed mental health counselor, healing through love, relationship healer, somatic body psychotherapist, and health and wellness coach, helping men and women heal their bodies and their relationships through love. Author of the Love Me, Touch Me, Heal Me book series, the romantic novel Love in the Blizzard of Life, and creator of the 30 Healing Through Love Lessons for Your Soul. This show is all about living your dreams, fulfilling your life purpose, and creating and sustaining love and health and total well-being for the rest of your life, no matter what age you are right now. And in every episode, I speak with vibrant, exciting, and positive men and women who keep proving that life can and often does get better and better as we reach our 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, and beyond. Author Mark Gober's world was turned upside down when exposed to world-changing scientific research. A partner in Silicon Valley in a Silicon Valley investment bank and strategy firm, and graduate of Princeton University, he was originally drawn to astrophysics to understand the universe. But instead, due to his athletic commitments on the Division I tennis team, he chose to study the forces that secretly drive human behavior, getting a degree in psychology, focusing on behavioral economics. Mark's world as he knew it turned upside down when he stumbled across several podcasts that caused him to question most basic assumptions about who and what we are as human beings. His book, An End to Upside Down Thinking, will change how you look at everything. And you can find him at Mark Gober, G-O-B-E-R, .com. And I'm so happy to speak with you today. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I'm excited to hear about your background. I never heard of behavioral economics and psychology. So if you could just tell us, you know, how this all developed, why you studied that, and then what happened after that.
Sure. So as an undergraduate student at Princeton, I started off studying economics, but decided that the field was very theoretical. It had assumed that people were rational. So all of the supply and demand curves that people draw in the economics field assume that there is a rational agent behind all of the actions. And I didn't seem to think that people were always rational. So I wondered if the standard economic theories were always correct. So it made me think about majoring in other things, and astrophysics was one thing that I was interested in, and I thought about doing it, but as you mentioned, I was on the tennis team, and I was later the captain of the team, so it would have been too much to do astrophysics. So instead, I decided to study psychology and kind of bridge it with the economic studies that I had done by examining rationality in human behavior. So the study of behavioral economics looks at how people behave when they're faced with decisions and how they act under risky situations. Are they always rational according to certain rules? And what you find over and over again is that people are often biased by things that make them act in a way that rationality would not predict.
Very interesting. So people
are
not so rational to the outside world, but they're rational to themselves.
Yeah, exactly. Internally, they think it's totally it's rational, but when we're evaluating it as an economist or someone else who has a set of rules that they consider rationality, people often act in a different way. So I can give an example. This is a famous example from prospect theory. And this was a theory that won the Nobel Prize. Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky were the ones who came up with it. And actually, my thesis at Princeton looked at this theory. So it looks at how people make decisions under risk. And they reversed one of the classic choices that people were asked to make in kind of rationality studies. The classic example is to give someone a choice and say, I can give you $5 for sure, or you can take a gamble and I'm going to flip a coin. Heads, you get zero. If it's tails, you get $10. What you find is that most people will take the sure thing. They'll take the $5. They will not take the gamble. And that's what rationality is. However, if you flip around the situation and you say, okay, you can either lose $5 for sure, or you can play a gamble, which is we flip a coin, and if it's heads, you lose zero, and if it's tails, you lose 10. What they find is that people will not take the sure loss. They'll take the gamble. They won't lose the $5 for sure. They'll say, I'll take the gamble of losing nothing or losing $10. So what we see is different behavior just if we're switching around whether the game is for gains or losses.
So they're more willing to take a loss?
They're more willing to take a risk. If they don't like to take a sure loss, whereas with the gains in the first game, people will say, I'll take the $5 for sure. With the losses, they won't give away $5 for sure. They'll say, I'd rather flip a coin to see if I can lose zero, even if I might lose more in the end. So it's known as risk-seeking behavior when faced with potential losses, whereas people are risk-averse when you're faced with potential gains. So these are nuances that the classic economic theories don't typically look at, but they're really important.
I never heard that before. It's really powerful. I'm going to watch, because I watch a lot of marketers, I'm going to watch how they word it. That's interesting.
The general principle is known as loss aversion, which is that people are more sensitive to losses than they are to gains. So losses feel worse than gains feel good.
Wow, that certainly happens in relationships.
Exactly. It happens in all areas of life. So I was really drawn to it and enjoyed studying it.
Wow.
That's what I studied in my undergraduate years. So I guess it showed that there was some interest in how the mind works, and with my initial interest in astrophysics, there was some interest in the broader universe. But I went into investment banking out of college. So I worked with UBS in New York, a large global investment bank, and I was there during the financial crisis. So 2008 to 2010 is when I worked there and decided to leave that field and joined my current firm called Sherpa Technology Group, where we advise tech companies on their innovation strategy, and we help them conduct transactions. So when I tell people about my career, they're often confused as to why I wrote a book about consciousness, because there's not really much of a connection on the surface. And it started for me in August of 2016. I initially heard a podcast on a show called Extreme Health Radio. I was just listening to health podcasts out of personal interest. And a woman came on the show who talked about her psychic abilities and her ability to work with energy. She talked about communications with the deceased and things that I had never really heard about in a serious way beyond science fiction. So I remember that I was interested in what she was saying because it was just so foreign to me. So I decided to end up listening to more podcasts along those lines. And then I started to do my own research. And I saw that there was science from very credible places like the U.S. government, like Princeton University, like the University of Virginia, and many credible scientists around the world throughout the ages have been looking at these phenomena. So it was a big worldview shift for me to realize that there was so much evidence that pointed in this direction of a much bigger reality than what I was exposed to. So it personally shifted my own worldview rather quickly, and all I wanted to do at that point was research. So I spent a full year researching when I wasn't in the office, reading books, listening to podcasts, finding interviews. Eventually, I spoke with many of the scientists myself. And then I decided after researching for a year, and after getting a lot of positive feedback from friends who said that it was really interesting, I decided to summarize my thoughts and put it on paper. So I ended up writing a good chunk of the book over the 4th of July weekend in 2017, which was a four-day weekend, and then I actually finished it over the next few weekends. So all of a sudden, I had no prior plans of writing a book, and it was the end of July 2017, and I had a draft manuscript. So it was a crazy process.
And I'm really excited. I'm going to be asking you about each of these phenomena, but you talk about some of these strange phenomena that some people think of as voodoo, like telepathy and remote viewing and precognition and psychokinesis. So I'd love to get into some of that. But first, you have a term for the book, you know, upside down thinking. So what does that mean?
What I now consider to be upside down thinking, and the title of the book is An End to Upside Down Thinking, is it's known as materialism, which in science refers to the idea that everything in the universe can be reduced to matter, physical stuff, like my table's made out of atoms of matter. So this the view of the universe under materialism is as follows. And I should say that this is kind of the view that's endorsed in much of scientific and medical thinking, and really much of Western society thinks this way, and I certainly did, which is that there was a Big Bang 13.8 billion years ago, started the universe, filled the universe with physical material called matter. So now we have a material universe at the basis of everything. And when you have enough random reactions between those pieces of matter in this big universe, you're bound to end up with a molecule that can replicate itself. And that's like DNA. So DNA leads to the evolution of biological organisms, like a human being. The human being develops a brain, and from the brain comes out consciousness. And when I say consciousness, I mean the subjective inner experience that we have, the awareness that we have of our own existence. So when I say I am speaking to you right now, that I, that sense of identity that's subjective, that's what I mean by consciousness. The view under materialism is that that consciousness that we're all experiencing right now, anyone listening to this conversation has a consciousness, that is solely a product of chemical activity in our brain, and our brain is made of matter. Matter creates consciousness under this view of materialism, which is what I consider to be upside down.
All right, so what is the opposite of that? What's right side
the
up?
The opposite, right side up. Yeah, the opposite of upside down thinking switches the placement of consciousness. And it says that consciousness isn't a byproduct of physical matter, not a byproduct of a physical brain, but rather consciousness comes at the very beginning, that consciousness is primary. So as the Nobel Prize winning physicist Max Planck said, who studied quantum physics in the early years, he said in 1931, "I regard consciousness as fundamental, and I regard matter as derivative from consciousness." This is a complete flip of the conventional perspective, which says that there was a big universe of matter and our consciousness emerged within it. What I'm arguing, and many others have argued, is that our consciousness is actually primary, and this entire physical universe is an experience occurring within consciousness. So our own consciousness is at a central place in existence.
All right, so let's get to some of the terms that you talk about. You know, I've heard so much about many of these. So one of them is telepathy. So explain what telepathy or telepathic abilities are, and is there evidence about it, and can any of us develop that?
Yes. So I'll first give a little bit of context for why even look at telepathy if we're thinking about consciousness. The way I structured the book and a lot of the research that I did was to look at phenomena that don't make sense if we assume that the brain produces consciousness. And another step back there is to note that science, even in the mainstream, has no idea how a physical brain can produce a non-physical consciousness. And what I mean by that is, if I can, I touch my leg, my leg is touchable, it's made of matter. My consciousness, however, I can't touch my consciousness, I can't touch my mind. So this is, it's known as the hard problem of consciousness. And Science Magazine has said it's the number two question that's left in all of science, which is how is it that this physical body that you can touch, how does it produce a non-physical consciousness? So already in the mainstream, there's a big question about it. What I've done in the book and through my research is to look at phenomena that maybe we've asked the wrong question. Maybe consciousness isn't coming from the brain at all, and maybe consciousness is existing beyond all space and time and is not localized to the body. So if there are phenomena that point that suggest that consciousness is not localized to the body, then maybe this idea of consciousness is primary is correct. So telepathy is one example out of many that I discuss in the book of, well, if telepathy is real, telepathy is mind-to-mind communication, and sometimes we see that in science fiction, but like, is there any reality to that in for a human being? Can someone actually communicate with their mind alone? Now, if the brain produces consciousness, and if consciousness is just stuck in your skull, then that telepathy doesn't make much sense. But if consciousness is primary and it kind of existing everywhere, then maybe we could reason that it would be possible. So telepathy is one example. People would call it paranormal under conventional scientific paradigms, but I would say that if we correct the upside-down thinking, then telepathy is not paranormal. It's actually what you would expect. And there is, to me, there's strong evidence for it. So I'll give one example of a controlled laboratory study that suggests that we all have subtle abilities. So these studies are done with people that are not claiming to be psychic. These are everyday people, sometimes college students. And the classic design puts one person in a room. We'll call him Bob. He's put into a very relaxed state. And in another room, we have Jane. Jane is shown an image by experimenters. Sometimes it's a movie clip, sometimes it's a picture. And the experimenters say, Bob is in the other room. He doesn't know what you're looking at. I want you to mentally send an image of what you're seeing to Bob in the other room, even though it sounds crazy. Just act like you're sending it to him with your mind. So Bob comes out of his relaxed state, and at the end of the time period, he is shown four pictures. And they say, Bob, which of the four was Jane looking at in the other room? And Bob doesn't know which one she was looking at, but if it were just chance, if there were no telepathic effect, Bob should guess correctly one out of four times, 25%, over many trials, over many decades. And that's how these studies have been done. But we don't find 25%. It's closer to 32%. And when you run statistics on this, the odds that that differential of 32 versus 25, the odds that that's just a chance occurrence, is like more than one in a billion. So it's showing that something seems to be getting through, even though it's very subtle. And if we think about our everyday experience, it actually makes a lot of sense. Because at least for me, I'm not 100% telepathic. I don't know what everyone else is thinking. But sometimes I'll think of something and then it happens. Or I'll think of something and then a person texts me and I was just thinking about that person. And it happens maybe in an unpredictable fashion. So it might be that we all have subtle abilities of this non-local consciousness, of this mind-to-mind communication that it takes statistics to detect.
Well, the thing that comes to mind immediately is people with their pets. The pet is not able to talk, but the owner knows very often what's going on.
Yes. And I have a chapter on animals in my book because so many pet owners report this exact phenomenon. And I think the strongest studies that have been done on this are by Dr. Rupert Sheldrake, a former Cambridge biochemist, who looked at a woman named Pam Smart and her dog, who Pam claimed really knew when she was coming home. So what Dr. Sheldrake did was to control for all of the things that might confound the experiment. So he would send Pam off in a taxi, so not even her own car. So we couldn't claim that the dog was just hearing the noise of her car because the dog knew what her car sounded like. And they would send her miles away. They would send her far away at times that were not her typical times of leaving home, so like at randomized times. And they had a videotape on the dog at home to see if the dog went to the window waiting for Pam, the pet owner, when Pam was coming home, if that was happening statistically significantly more often when Pam was coming home. And what they found was that when Pam was, again, miles away in a taxi cab, she was basically told when to come home at a random time. The minute that she decided that she was going to come home and walk to her taxi cab, we would see the dog walk to the window. So
that's
suggests,
amazing.
Like you're saying, it's amazing. And Dr. Sheldrake has videos of this on his website. You can see the design of the study. But he ran nearly 200 replications of this, And when we run statistics, this is happening at a statistically significant level where the dog is going to the window when she is on her way home.
Wow. So that's telepathy. What about knowing the future before it happens? Precognition.
Precognition. Yeah, so this is a really tricky one to think about because we like to think of time as being linear, where it goes from past to present to future. But in my studies, I'm beginning to question that more and more. And like I said earlier, I now think of consciousness as actually being beyond all space and time. So when we talk about precognition, where some future event that is not known is affecting the past, it really starts to put into question our notion of time. So the best studies that I've seen on this, where we're actually looking at controlled laboratory settings, involve a very subtle effect again, where people's bodies are being measured before an image is shown on a computer screen. And I've actually done these studies at the Institute of Noetic Sciences. I've sat in on it, where you're looking at a computer screen and you don't know what kind of picture is going to be shown. And the experimenter doesn't know either because it's randomly generated. So sometimes you'll see like a very neutral picture, a picture of a mountain or a river, something that you know in psychological studies doesn't arouse the body very much. But then other times you'll see a picture that's like a violent image or something that's very disturbing or something that's erotic, things that we know will at a subconscious level stimulate the body. So I remember this from my psychology years. If you show someone a violent picture and you measure their skin, they'll have an unconscious response where their skin actually responds to it or their pupils will dilate. And that's the traditional psychological study, which is you show the image and then you're measuring the body's response. And then after the image is shown, the body responds in an unconscious way. So that's not controversial. What has been done in these studies is to measure the body before the picture is even shown. And who would ever think to do that? Because how could the body respond to a future event that's not known because the picture is randomly generated? But what the experimenter seems to find is that there is a very subtle but highly statistically significant effect where the body is responding seconds before the picture is shown, in a direction consistent with what the eventual picture is.
That's pretty amazing.
It's amazing. It's mind-blowing. The body is knowing subtly the future before the future happens. And these studies are extremely controversial, as you might imagine, because it challenges so much of what we think we already know. Dr. Daryl Bem, former professor at Cornell University, who was a conventional psychologist for many years, he had a study published on this topic within the last decade or so that really got a lot of attention to this topic. So some people claim that the statistics are not good on these studies. Others claim that, well, when you combine all the studies together, you get a real statistical effect. And it's one that has not been – I don't think it's been settled in the mainstream scientific community. But to me, when you look at the accumulated evidence of many different scientists, it's called a meta-analysis when you combine everything. There seems to be a statistical effect, and it matches what many people report on their own. So sometimes we hear of precognitive dreams where a person dreams something and then it happens the next day in vivid detail. So there are reports like this anecdotally, and to me these studies where the body is reacting to something in the future subtly, that's just kind of a confirmation or a validation of many things that have been talked about.
It's just that consciousness is very strong, and when people believe a certain way, this is so opposite of their belief that it's very hard to change it, even if they see
exactly.
The evidence.
Exactly.
So
I want
to keep having questions because there's so many aspects to this. So knowing that consciousness is powerful like that, can we really impact physical matter with our consciousness, with our mind?
Well, if we think about this idea that consciousness is primary, meaning it's more fundamental than anything physical, then at least conceptually it would make sense that the material world could be affected by consciousness, almost like the material world is malleable. So that conceptually we would think that would happen, that the mind could affect matter. And in fact, there are studies that suggest this happens. Again, sometimes it's at a very subtle statistical level. The best studies, in my mind, are ones that were done at Princeton, actually, by the former dean of engineering, Dr. Robert John, a and they've been continued by Dr. Roger Nelson and Brenda Dunn, looking at machines. So these are physical machines made out of matter. These are computers that are called random number generators. And these are machines that generate zeros and ones in a totally random fashion. So when you look at the string of zeros and ones that have been produced, over time, you end up with 50% ones and 50% zeros. And that's what you would expect because it's random. What the experimenters do in the studies is to ask people to, they'll say, okay, Bob, you're thinking about this machine. I want you to mentally intend for the machine to produce more ones and zeros. Like make the machine do it without touching it. Use your mind. And this is just an everyday person who's doing this at a distance to the machine. What the experimenters find is that the machines do behave in a slightly non-random fashion where it's like slightly more ones and zeros. It's not 50-50 anymore in the instances where a person is trying to make the machine produce more ones and zeros.
Yeah. Wow. Each one of these is like a wow because, you know, what do you say? It's such a surprise that it's been studied so much.
It's shocking.
I mean, it's shocking to the system. I mean, I have seen it in terms, heard about it, in terms of healing the body. There's many stories of people who have healed through prayer, you know, believing in the prayer, or just through their own consciousness. In their mind, I remember someone doing this 30 years ago, teaching clients to act like Pac-Man in their brain and picture cancer cells dying. And the person got over the cancer. You know, so there's a lot to it. But we don't have much support for that in the media and in our general society.
I agree with you. And to me, it's because of this belief that the brain produces consciousness. And if we think consciousness is just this byproduct of the brain that has no effect on the world around us, then a lot of the ideas that we're discussing today don't make any sense. So that's where I used to be, I think, in my thinking. Now that I can recontextualize it, it's easy to just sweep these things under the rug because they don't make any sense under the conventional paradigm and the assumption that the brain is producing consciousness. And that's why I wrote a whole book, which is different areas of study, whether it's telepathy or psychokinesis or children who have memories of a previous life or near-death experiences, et cetera. These are all challenging that assumption that the brain produces consciousness. And my hope is that if we get rid of that assumption and we say, well, maybe consciousness is something else, then all of these ideas and thinking about alternative health and the ability for the mind to heal us and so many other topics, they become much more believable and they become worthy of study.
Well, what's important about your book, as I'm listening to you, is the background that you have, the approach you're taking, is very different from so many of the books out there on these topics. Most of them, from my understanding, are written by people who are psychic and have the psychic ability, or therapists, or someone who has seen it and worked with it. But you've done it from the research and scientific approach, and that's powerful.
Yeah, thank you for saying that. That was one of the things I noticed in my research, and probably one of the reasons I felt so compelled to write this book, is that I saw a gap in the literature where, you're right, there are many books that are written by practitioners who've had the experiences, but it's very anecdotal. And for someone who's used to scientific studies, they won't even pick up that book, or they'll put it down after two pages because they're not seeing the rigor of analytical approaches that they're used to. Then on the other end of the spectrum, I saw books written by PhDs that were so complex that an everyday person wouldn't pick it up or they wouldn't get it. So the challenge that I put on myself was to do something in the middle that had the scientific rigor but explained it in a way that an everyday person who's not a scientist could understand. And that's what I'm hoping the book is able to do.
Well, it certainly sounds like it, listening to you. And I have the book. I'm looking forward to reading it. Does our consciousness survive when our physical body dies? Because you said our consciousness is the precursor.
Yeah. I mean, now I do think that consciousness transcends the body, and that when the body dies, consciousness is simply transitioning. So there is an assumption in mainstream society that I certainly bought into, which is that consciousness, when the body dies and the brain turns off, then consciousness is gone. Memories are gone, and that has implications for how we think about life and meaning. So to me, that life didn't have meaning because once you die, it's over. So you don't have any memories or feelings. How can there be any meaning? And that's what I would kind of ruminate on before my research. And now if we think about consciousness differently, where it's not dependent on the brain, I mean, if you kind of just think about it conceptually, when I look at a person, I can't see their consciousness, but based on the way they're acting, I assume that they have a consciousness. To assume in society mm-hmm. that when their body stops functioning, that the consciousness goes away, but we could never see it in the first place. So it's like, it's kind of an assumption to just say that the consciousness goes away just because we're not seeing behavior. But the research to me suggests that consciousness is not dying when the body dies. And there are a number of areas that I talk about. I know we don't have too much time, but I'll mention one. The near-death experience to me is really compelling because there are cases of cardiac arrest in particular. These are instances where a person is in extreme physiological trauma. Their heart has stopped. There's no blood flowing to the brain. Their brain is off. And there are cardiologists like Dr. Pim Van Lommel, Dr. Bruce Grayson at the University of Virginia, who will examine patients that have survived cardiac arrest. They've been resuscitated. In a study done by Dr. Pim Van Lommel, a cardiologist, he found that 18% of these types of patients had lucid, vivid memories. They were in cardiac arrest. Conventional thinking would say that 0% should have any kind of a memory, and yet these are people, 18% had lucid memories. So that is suggesting that there is a consciousness existing where memories are being formed independently of a functioning body.
And along with that, is there evidence for past lives?
I think there is. And again, if we think about consciousness differently, that it's beyond all space and time, then it would make sense that consciousness could be inhabiting, so to speak, many bodies. And the work at the University of Virginia, Dr. Ian Stevenson and Dr. Jim Tucker have been the lead researchers in this area, have looked at children who are usually between the ages of 2 and 5 years old, over 2,500 cases studied to years. These are children who have spontaneous memories of a life that is not theirs at this very young age. And sometimes the details are so specific that the researchers can find medical records that match up with what the child described. And sometimes the children actually have birthmarks and physical deformities on their body that are aligned with the ways in which they describe dying in the previous life. And again, sometimes the researchers can find medical records that verify that the person did in fact die in that way.
It's so much. It's really exciting to hear about so much of this, that you brought it together into one book. So,
yeah.
Now another question about this. Knowing how powerful our mind is, how might we view life and death differently?
Well, I can give an answer based on my own experience. And as I alluded to earlier, I thought life was temporary and we're in a single body. And once the body stops functioning, that's the end. And there's no memory of what happened because once your brain's off, your consciousness is gone. Now I have a much more expansive view of things that views the body kind of as a temporary stop and almost like a learning vehicle for us to have experiences. But that the awareness that we all experience right now, the awareness that is experiencing the body, that consciousness goes on. It's a huge shift to really internalize that idea, and it took me a lot of time and a lot of seeing research to really to begin to get it. At first, I resisted it, or I just didn't fully understand it. And as I've dug into this more and more, it's now becoming a more natural way of looking at the world.
And when I look at the world that way, it helps me to handle any circumstance and just say, what am I learning here? What's the lesson for me? And it takes away some of the pain that you feel when you're upset by not having things the way you want them to be.
Things into a different context. And it tends to be a more comforting picture of reality. And it's actually one of the reasons that I probably would have rejected these things before I began down this path, which is that I thought that people believed in these things because it was comforting and they wanted to rid themselves of the kind of terrifying worldview that science was pointing towards, which is that life is temporary and has no meaning. So in order to avoid that, people were just rationalizing and coming up with a comforting view of reality. And now I just think that logic I just gave you, it discounted the possibility that reality could at the same time be comforting and true. And that's what I now think.
Beautiful. So what are the implications for world peace? If we know that our consciousness is primary.
Yeah, this is probably the most significant implication to me. When I say that consciousness is primary, one of the other ideas that I discuss in the book is that we are interconnected as part of the same underlying consciousness, even though we have this appearance of separation where it feels like there's a me and a you. And that's what our eyes show us and our perceptual systems in the body show us separation. What seems to be the case is that there's an interconnectivity at the level of consciousness. As Erwin Schrödinger, who's a famous Nobel Prize winning physicist, he said, in truth, there is only one mind. And that's now where I come out as well, where there's kind of one mind that's having this diversity of experiences through many different life forms and bodies. And if that's really true, that we are not as separate as our eyes show us, think about what that means about how we should be treating each other. It becomes irrational to do intentional harm to others if you really believe that we have the same consciousness at the basis of everything. So to me, when I look at the problems in the world today, they stem from the belief that we're separate and that we're finite creatures. But if we're not finite, meaning we have a lifespan of our consciousness extending beyond the body, and if our consciousness have this interconnected nature, then it becomes irrational to do some of the things we see people doing in the world.
And so the next part of that, one part is the world. What about in our interpersonal relationships, one-on-one, at work, with family, with friends, neighbors? What are the implications for happiness and love and beauty and connection?
Yeah. Those are important topics too, because on a day-to-day basis, we're not necessarily affecting world peace. But in our relationships, we can have the same kinds of thinking. If we think that it's really important to treat others well, no matter who that other person is, we might just be more giving or more altruistic in general, rather than just focusing on ourselves, which is what the materialist perspective of we're all separate and finite, that it would endorse that perspective, that others don't matter as much. So I think with interpersonal relationships, there might be go ahead.
There's another piece to it, and that is to trust that your consciousness is powerful and that your consciousness is affecting the other person even when they don't appear to be responding the way you think they should.
Exactly. That's right. We begin to be much more aware of even our thinking about other people and the intentions we're putting forth in addition to our actions.
It would become much more intentional. I think we have to kind of slow down our thinking and be very aware of what we're thinking and saying.
Yes. Yes, it's a new paradigm. It's not what we're taught in school.
No. All right, so we're coming to the end. So tell us how our listeners can get access to your information, to you. Do you have anything that you're offering, any services about this?
My website, which is my name, at markgober.com, markgober.com, has more information on me and my book, which is called An End to Upside Down Thinking. And the book summarizes what we discussed on this show and much more, and all the science that backs it up. And the book is available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and many other bookstores. So I think the book is a place to start. So I have my own podcast that will be coming out sometime in 2019. Don't have an exact date yet, but I've interviewed many of the scientists that I discuss in my book. So not only in the book, you can read my summaries of what they've done and read some of their quotes. And in my podcast, you can hear me actually speak to them. So I think for certain people, that will be another way for them to learn more information.
Wow, sounds wonderful. Well, thank you for what you're putting out into the world. It's really valuable for all of us.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. And thank you so much for having me on your show.
And thank you for being here. What a delight. And I look forward to speaking to you again some other time.
Yeah, absolutely.
And to those of you listening, thank you so much for being here. And I look forward to speaking to you again soon.